This is a summary of Freezing Order by bestbookbriefings.com. Freezing Order. A true story of money laundering, murder, and surviving Vladimir Putin's wrath. Meeting Moscow. In 1996, I moved to Moscow in order to set up a hedge called the Hermitage Fund. It wasn't easy. The companies we'd invested in were being robbed by corrupt officials and Russian oligarchs. While everyone accepted this as the cost of doing business, I decided to fight back. We researched how much was being stolen, how it was being stolen, and who was profiting from it. We used this information to file lawsuits, brief the government, and publicize the scandals to international media. This tactic turned out to be so profitable for our client companies that the Hermitage Fund became one of the highest performing funds in the world, clocking at $4.5 billion worth of equities at its height. But it didn't make me a popular man in Russia. In November 2005, Vladimir Putin declared that I was a threat to national security and had me expelled from Russia. To protect our clients, my team liquidated our holdings, and most of them evacuated with me to London. 18 months later, our office was raided by officers from the Russian Interior Ministry, and items like seals and certificates were used to falsely re-register our fund's ownership of investment holding companies to other people. While this was of no great loss to us, since we'd already liquidated our assets, the Russian authorities had opened a criminal case on one of my colleagues as a pretext for the raids. In order to defend him, we employed a team of Russian lawyers, who found that the evidence they'd used against him was entirely fabricated. But as they dug deeper, they found even worse things. One of our lawyers, a man by the name of Sergei Magnitsky, found that our stolen companies had been used to apply for a fraudulent tax refund to the tune of $230 million, the same amount of taxes our companies had paid after we had liquidated our assets. The request was approved in a single day, and paid out in full 2 days later, mainly to a shady Russian bank called Universal Savings Bank. It was the largest tax refund in Russia's history, and with the Interior Ministry working hand in hand with the criminal underground, it was a theft that we were being framed for. Two of our lawyers immediately fled, but Sergei Magnitsky stayed, against our wishes. He believed that Russia was in the process of changing for the better, and that the law would protect him. But he needed reinforcements. Four different people referred me to a lawyer called John Moscow. John Moscow had served at the New York District Attorney's Office for more than 3 decades, and had built up a reputation as one of their most aggressive prosecutors against domestic corruption and international financial crime. I took the opportunity to meet him. He seemed unassuming at first, but once we got down to business, I found that I liked the way he thought, and I was sure that he was someone I wanted on our side. Tracking footprints. On October 2, 2008, the Russian Interior Ministry opened criminal cases against two of our lawyers who had fled to London. Effectively, their logic was that they couldn't represent our companies that had been stolen, since they no longer belonged to us. Sergei was so offended by this tactic that despite the obvious danger, he went straight to the Russian State Investigative Committee to lay out all of the facts at his disposal. He testified that the criminal group that had stolen our companies had also stolen the $230 million. He didn't stop there. Sergei found documents that showed that 1 year prior, the same group had stolen $107 million worth of taxes paid by a different company. This needed to go public as soon as possible. I called the bureau chief of Business Week, a man named Jason Bush, who spent the next few weeks investigating. He found that this criminal group had a strategy of sending billions of rubles to shell companies that had abandoned apartments as their listed addresses. As soon as the money was transferred back out of them, they would shortly be dissolved. It was an outright scandal. 16 days after the article was published, the Interior Ministry arrested Sergei in his home, in front of his wife and son. Our problems with the Russians had been virtual up until then. But now, they had a real-life hostage. They're going to use him as a bargaining chip, John said. We need leverage to get him out of jail. To do that, we need to know where the money went. But the money got sent from one bank to another, I said. How are we going to trace it? Simple. If it's in dollars, it's in New York. Whenever money is transferred in dollars, it first has to go through a U.S. clearing bank for a fraction of a second, which leaves a permanent record. This is true no matter where in the world you are. Those clearing banks are stationed in Manhattan under the jurisdiction of U.S. courts. John Moscow explained that we could use something called a 1782 subpoena to put the trail back together. It was a shrewd approach, but on December 11, Bernie Madoff was charged with a massive case of fraud, and suddenly John Moscow was almost impossible to reach. At first, I was confused, then frustrated. Then I was just angry. In January, it became clear that John's law firm had been placed in charge of unwinding Madoff's state of bankruptcy, a task that they were going to earn a pretty penny for. I'd naively assumed that John would be bound by his professional duty to advocate for his client no matter what, but I was wrong. By the late spring of 2009, we were getting reports that Sergey was being tortured in prison, depriving him of sleep, heating, and proper toilets. Their goal seemed to be to have him drop his testimony and sign a false confession that he had stolen the $230 million at my instruction. But he refused to go against his principles. After 7 months of incarceration, his health had severely deteriorated, requiring him to undergo an operation for pancreatitis and gallstones. Desperate to get him out of there, we did everything we could. We contacted many organizations, all of which the Russians ignored. We hired a new law firm and submitted the 1782 subpoenas to the court, but the clearing banks that were responsible for the dollar payments in the question, J.P. Morgan and Citibank, sent back incomplete information. A week before Sergey's operation was scheduled, his captors tried to convince him to sign a false confession, but he refused, again. They moved him to a maximum security jail called Butyrka, widely considered one of the worst in Russia, with no medical facilities whatsoever. Although Sergey was in constant, excruciating pain, he was refused any treatment. Sergey had one last hope. Russian law states that a person can only be kept in pretrial detention for 365 days afterwards. They must either be put on trial or released. The Russian government couldn't put him on trial. To do so would give Sergey an international platform to expose the multi-million-dollar fraud, as well as all of the government officials that were involved. Although the court could and would find him guilty anyway, it wouldn't silence him. So they silenced him instead. On the night of November 16, 2008, Sergey Magnitsky went into critical condition. Unwilling to take responsibility, the authorities at Butyrka transferred him across town to another detention center with a medical wing. But instead of being placed in the emergency room, they put Sergey in an isolation center and chained him to a bed. 8 riot guards came in and beat him to death with rubber batons. He was 37 years old. The roadmap. The call that I received the next morning is still the most heartbreaking and traumatizing moment in my life. Sergey had been killed for trying to do the right thing. He'd been killed because he was working for me. I carry the guilt with me every day. When I was able to clear my mind, there was only one I knew I could do: direct all of my time, energy, and resources into making sure that anyone who was involved in Sergey's fraudulent arrest, torture, and murder, as well as anyone who had benefited from the $230 million, would be put to justice. And so I did. We peppered every law enforcement agency in Russia with criminal complaints, backed by a mountain of evidence. Sergey and his lawyers had spent the last year compiling the most well-documented case of human rights abuse in Russia in the last 4 decades. The Russians would have to do something. Instead, they closed their ranks as authorities began a full-scale cover-up. They denied his family's request for an independent autopsy, and denied that he had ever been sick. But 2 weeks after Sergey's murder, we would soon receive more details about the cover-up. One of Russia's best investigative journalists reported that FSB officials had received $6 million in cash as a bribe to arrest Sergey and cover up the $230 million fraud. We went back to J.P. Morgan and Citibank and demanded every single dollar-based payment from dozens of banks in Russia over the last 2 years. All in all, it amounted to over 1.3 million transactions. We thought it was the key, but we shortly realized that there was too much information. The only way we could make sense of thousands and thousands of company names and account numbers was if we had some sort of context, a roadmap that would link any of this data to the $230 million fraud. We pivoted and focused on the most visible perpetrators, like Pavel Karpov and Artem Kuznetsov, who were the Interior Ministry officers who were responsible for the seizing of our offices, and Dmitry Klyuev, who was the owner of Universal Savings Bank. Klyuev was initially hard to trace, but Karpov and Kuznetsov were the opposite. Shortly after the $230 million was stolen, they both went on lavish spending sprees, seemingly unconcerned about the potential controversy. In response, we made a pair of YouTube videos about them, which went viral, particularly in Russia. This led us to a Russian whistleblower, a man named Alexander Poropylygny. He was a financial advisor to Olga Spinova, the tax official who had approved the tax refund, and he had evidence that $11 million of that money had gone to their accounts in Zurich. He showed U.S. bank statements that led to two shell companies, which we could then trace back to another shell company, and another until we could follow the path of the $11 million from Russia into Switzerland. Our enemies thought they could hide their tracks, but they were wrong. The Magnitsky Act. Anyone who watched our YouTube videos about Karpov and Kuznetsov wanted to see justice done. One way to do this was to make sure that they couldn't use their ill-gained wealth to go on fancy international holidays, or even deposit their money abroad. Slowly, this sentiment grew into the legislative proposal called the Magnitsky Act, which would bend the visas and freeze the assets of Russian human rights violators, like the ones who had tortured and killed Sergei Magnitsky. Support for this act was widespread in Washington, and the United States as a whole, but to make it really effective, we needed a European Magnitsky Act, as well. I had some trouble gaining supporters until I met Boris Nemtsov, a living legend. 1. He was President Yeltsin's deputy prime minister and potential successor, but after witnessing the corruption and oppression of the Putin regime, Boris became one of the most notoriously outspoken critics of the regime. He'd been arrested many times for organizing demonstrations and writing reports that were critical of Putin's illegitimate wealth, and he refused to be bribed or intimidated. He thought the Magnitsky Act was genius. "We'll make sure these bastards never forget Sergei Magnitsky's name," Boris said. From that day onward, Boris Nemtsov became my partner in advocating the Magnitsky Act and seeking justice for Sergei. The Cambridge Crime Conference. Although Boris's support increased our chances of getting the Magnitsky Act passed, I knew that even in the best-case scenario, it would take years for it to become law. We had to act on something now, like the millions of dollars that were sitting on a Zurich bank account that belonged to Olga Spinova. We didn't need a new law to go after it. It was money laundering, pure and simple. All we needed to do was to convince the Swiss authorities to act on it. In the interest of meeting Swiss prosecutors, I attended the Cambridge International Symposium on Economic Crime. But he wasn't interested. In retrospect, it might have been naive for me to think a random person at a conference could kickstart a Swiss criminal investigation. But as I walked outside, I ran into an unexpected face. John Moscow. Of course, he'd be here. I was still furious at him for abandoning my team, but when we made eye contact, he greeted me and shook my hand as if nothing had happened. I swallowed my anger. If John Moscow wanted to make nice, it would be to my advantage. He referred me to a man named Adam Kaufman, who worked at the DAZ office in New York. He was intrigued by my story about the fraud and Sergei's murder, but for him to be able to do anything, he needed some concrete proof of money stored in accounts in New York, or any relevant persons owning property in the city, a New York nexus, so to speak. If it existed, we would find it. Blaming the dead. On November 15, 2010, just a day before the first anniversary of Sergei's murder, the Russian government officially blamed him for stealing the $230 million. An Interior Ministry press conference laid out an elaborate conspiracy theory that linked Sergei with three other people: Oktay Gazanov, Valery Kurikin, and Semyon Korobinikov. All three of these men had died in suspicious manners a few years prior. As such, there was no way of either proving a connection or defending their innocence. There was no mention of Dmitry Klyuev, the owner of University Savings Bank, but it was then that we started to do our own research on him. One of the things we discovered was that the Interior Ministry had actually worked to get him out of a jam once before, when in 2006 Klyuev was caught trying to use Universal Savings Bank in order to steal $1.60 billion worth of shares from a Russian oligarch. The oligarch opened a criminal case on him, but another familiar name showed up to assist him: Karpov, the crooked official. Klyuev got off with a suspended sentence. The Swiss complaint. On March 22, 2011, Moscow named a new actor in the conspiracy they were building around the $230 million tax fraud, an ex-convict by the name of Vyacheslav Klebnikov. He was still alive, but he was also known in the mafia as a stand-up guy, a person who was willing to take the fall for his associates' crimes. He pleaded guilty to being a central figure in the theft, and verified that Sergei and the other three dead men had assisted him. He was found guilty based solely on his confession, and judged with the minimum sentence of 5 years in a penal colony, with no fine or requirement to reveal the stolen money's location. The authorities would conclude that Olga Spinova, along with several other tax officials who had been key to the illegal tax refund, had been tricked, and were in fact, victims. To hell with this, I thought. These guys can't just keep sweeping this under the rug. We're not going to wait for the Swiss to make a decision. John Moscow had introduced me to an old friend, a reporter named Bill Alpert, who had a reputation for writing long-form, hard-hitting investigative exposés on corruption. We worked together, and on April 16, 2011, he published an article called Crime and Punishment in Putin's Russia, 2,800 words detailing the money laundering trail we'd uncovered, and how $11 million of it had ended up in the Spinova bank account in Zurich. It described Klyuev's involvement and challenged the Swiss to take things seriously. A week later, the Swiss announced that they had frozen the money that Spinova was holding. It was the first freezing order in the Magnitsky case, but it wouldn't be the last. Out of the shadows. On July 4, 2012, I headed to Monaco to attend the annual meeting of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Hundreds of parliamentarians from all over the world were meeting up to discuss human rights, democracy, and security, and today they were going to vote on a resolution that would urge all OSCE member states to pass Magnitsky Acts in their countries. I'd been invited by the Parliamentary Assembly's Secretary General, a man named Spencer Oliver. I thought it'd be a good opportunity to premiere a YouTube video we'd made about Dmitry Klyuev, in a similar style to the ones we'd made about Karpov Kuznetsov. After all, no other single human was more representative of the twisted symbiosis between Russian organized crime and the Russian government. On the day of the vote itself, I got the news that Dmitry Klyuev and Andrei Pavlov were meeting with Spencer Oliver in his office. They were trying to convince us to take the Magnitsky Act off the agenda. This was unprecedented. The Russian FSB had a lot of tricks up their sleeve, but dispatching a major organized crime boss in an attempt to lobby the head of an international organization. There was no way Spencer would have agreed to meet him unless the Russian government had formally asked for the meeting. It proved our point: the Klyuev organized crime group and the Russian government were one and the same. They'd overplayed their hand in a spectacular fashion. With the aid of a nearby camera crew, we managed to get some footage of Klyuev and showed it to MPs at the assembly. Any doubts about the necessity of the Magnitsky Act evaporated immediately. When they convened, the vote wasn't even close. Soon after, Swiss law enforcement had taken it upon themselves to freeze Klyuev's bank accounts in Switzerland. It was the second freezing order in the Magnitsky case. It would not be the last. The Moldovan files. Right after Monaco, Bill Alpert called with the news. He'd gained access to the database that contained all the wire transfers for a bank called Banca de Economic, which was located in Moldova. This was crucial information for us, as the trail had gone cold after the $11 million that had ended up in Switzerland. We found that $55 million of the money had gone to two Moldovan companies that were in the files. Bill ran through the dozens and dozens of shell companies that redistributed that money and checked to see if any of them had purchased any property in New York. He got one hit: Prevezen Holdings, who had received $857,664 from the Moldovan companies, and yet, had purchased roughly $17 million worth of real estate in New York. The owner, Denis Katsev, the son of a senior government official in Russia. Although Bill's newspaper refused to publish the article out of their own interests, a newly formed NGO called the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, or the ACRP, did. Their website only got a fraction of the traffic, but one of the people who did was a compliance officer at UBS in Zurich, which was a bank that held $7 million of Prevezen's money. They filed a report with Swiss law enforcement, which pushed through. It was the third freezing order in the Magnitsky case. Adam Kaufman had wanted a New York nexus, and we'd found one. New York was next. The New York nexus. On December 14, 2012, the U.S. Senate passed the Magnitsky Act to a vote of 92-4, and President Obama signed it into law. I felt like the tide was turning. But at the same time, the Russians were beginning their retaliation. This was the first time that the United States had sanctioned them since the Cold War, and Vladimir Putin was furious. Putin got personally involved in covering up Sergei's murder, pronouncing at his annual press conference that Sergei had never been tortured, and that he had simply died from a heart attack. He also mentioned me and Sergei by name in relation to our economic crimes. A week later, Moscow set a date to put me on trial, alongside Sergei, the first time a dead person would be put on trial in Russia's history. On March 6, 2013, NTV, a Russian state-controlled television station, aired a 45-minute-long propaganda piece called Browder's List on primetime, alleging that not only was I a tax evader, but I'd in fact stolen $4.5 billion worth of IMF bailout funds, and that I'd killed my former business partner, Edmund Safra, a man who had died tragically in a fire in 1998. This was standard practice before any major political show trial. The aim was to convince the Russian public that the defendant was a monster. In May, Russia issued their first Interpol red notice for my arrest. I had been upgraded to their international wanted list. Fortunately, my lawyers stepped in, and Interpol deleted the listing from their system due to its political motivation. In July, both Sergei and I were found guilty of criminal tax evasion, and I was sentenced to 9 years of hard labor, in absentia. Russia requested another red notice, but was rejected again. In short, Putin was using the weight of the Russian government to crush anyone who was associated with me and the Magnitsky case. It was harrowing, to say the least, and I would have to wait for a long time before I would find any strong allies. In September 2013, I received the news that the Department of Justice was asking the U.S. federal court to issue a worldwide freezing order over all of Prevezin's assets, $20 million of which they'd found in New York, and $3.5 million in the Netherlands, more than 27 times the $857,764 we'd found in our own investigations. The facts were laid out in black and white. The next, the application was approved, the fourth freezing order in the Magnitsky case. The evidence was so damning that I assumed the Russians wouldn't even bother to defend themselves. Instead, they dug in their heels and fought us every step of the way. They went so far as to hire my old lawyer, John Moscow, to work against me. It was a massive breach of ethics. Moscow already had all the information he could use against me from working with me as a client. The Russians, I could understand stooping that low, but not him. They demanded outrageous subpoena after outrageous subpoena, demanding that I provide them with every piece of data about the Hermitage Fund's business dealings. Considering the kinds of people we were dealing with, this would mean putting everyone I'd ever known and worked with in danger. We fought them all the way for years, dealing with obstacles like senile judges and two depositions. Through it all, my friends and family stood with me, and supported me as I promoted the hell out of my first book, Red Notice. Sergei Magnitsky died abused and alone. If I did nothing else, I was going to make sure everyone knew about it. The Cellist. In April 2016, the famous Panama Papers story came out, revealing 11 million documents that contained the financial details of hundreds of thousands of offshore companies and accounts. Of particular interest to us was the star of Russia's particular show, Sergei Radyugin, a cellist who controlled companies that had been accumulating billions of dollars worth of assets and coincidentally happened to be Putin's best friend. Putin loves his money, but because he's the president, he can only earn his official salary of around $300,000 a year. As such, Putin needed people he could trust to hold his money for him. People like Radyugin. If we could trace any of the stolen $230 million to Putin through Radyugin, it could change everything. Through the Panama Papers, we found a shell company belonging to Radyugin called Delco Networks, which had $800,000 from the tax refund. We now had a direct link from the crime that Sergei Magnitsky had exposed and had been murdered for to Radyugin, and to the president of Russia himself. This explained everything. When Sergei was murdered, Putin could have chosen to prosecute the perpetrators, but he didn't. When the international community demanded justice, he exonerated everyone who was involved. Putin's government had arranged for the mobster Dmitry Klyuev and his lawyer Andrei Pavlov, both private citizens, to attend a parliamentary assembly and lobby against the act, like they were special government envoys. Why would Putin go to such lengths to protect a group of crooks? Simply put, he was protecting himself. The $800,000 we had traced back to him seemed like a small amount, but it was just one of the hundreds of other offshore trust companies. If those companies' books were exposed, I do not doubt that we would find more of Putin's trustees, who had also received bits and pieces of the $230 million. And this was just one crime in the thousands and thousands that had occurred during his administration. This was just the tip of the iceberg. The Magnitsky Act states that Russian human rights violators will have their Western assets frozen, along with the beneficiaries of the $230 million theft. Putin's status as a human rights violator was not up for debate, but now he qualified for the other definition. The Magnitsky Act put his wealth and power at risk. This made Putin a very angry man. This was personal. We'd hit Vladimir Putin's Achilles heel. The war at home. The most difficult, most outrageous part of my years-long struggle against the Russians was that they weren't working alone. Along every step of the way, they were being assisted by Western enablers. It's one thing for the Russians to act the way they do, their society is harsh and unforgiving. There are very few rewards for doing the right thing, so it takes exceptional individuals like Sergei Magnitsky and Boris Nemtsov to rise above nihilism and corruption. But in the West, especially in America, things are different. We have our own issues, but Americans like John Moscow have lived charmed, privileged lives, and operated in a society that aspires to honor good conduct and ethics. For people like them to use their talents and resources in the service of nothing more than money or personal interest can only be seen as contemptible. None more so than Donald Trump himself. Much has been said about his alleged collusion with Putin, as well as his infamous instability, but I was profoundly and personally affected by his administration. During those turbulent years, we had to contend with the potential hobbling or dismantling of the Magnitsky Act, which I'd worked so hard to pass. Notoriously, during their first summit together, Putin offered Trump 12 GRU operatives in exchange for me, and Trump considered it an incredible offer. Both incidents were clear results of Putin's government influencing him, and both were only overturned by an effective appeal to the rest of the American government, who came together to support a righteous cause. $234 billion. In September 2018, Danske Bank, which was the same bank that laundered $200 million connected to the Magnitsky case, published the results of their audit, revealing how much dirty money had flowed out of Russia through their branch over the past decade. The answer was $234 billion. More than 1,000 times what we had identified. If you could lift the hood on every Western bank, I estimate you would find over $1 trillion worth of dirty money. When we'd started investigating the $230 million, we had no idea where it would lead, or how much of a reaction it would garner from Russia. Now it all made sense. With more than $1 trillion at stake, Putin was ready to do anything to protect it. So many people were murdered, lives swept under the rug. As you followed my story, you might wonder, the odds are so incredibly long, and the process is so risky. Why do you do any of this? At first, it was because I owed it to Sergei. As things escalated, it became a struggle for survival for me and my family, and my friends and colleagues. But in the end, I did it because it was the right thing to do. At the time of writing, more than 34 different countries have adopted their own version of the Magnitsky Act. More than 500 individuals have been sanctioned through these laws, including every Russian that was involved in Sergei's murder and the $230 million tax refund scheme. But these sanctions have also been applied to human rights violators all over the world. For every person or organization who has been affected, thousands more wait in terror to see if they're next. I can't bring Sergei back, but his sacrifice has saved and will continue to save many lives. If Russia ever has a proper democratic reckoning, they will expand on these legal monuments by building a physical one to a real hero, Sergei Magnitsky. But for now, the fight continues. Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.